This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. The Mesa Trail at UC Santa Barbara is now open to the public.
They donated it to campus in 2013, but of course they weren't really donating a golf course. They were donating the promise of a restoration project.
Also, Father Ian takes us along while he forages for mushrooms.
When I look underneath it, I'm hoping to see amethyst-colored gills.
Yeah, this is doing it.
Oh, wow, look at that.
It's very cool.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, May 23rd, 2022. I'm Brad Kyle. Major General Laura Yeager retires after 36 years of service. She spoke with KCBX's Tom Wilmer.
Reporting from Camp San Luis Obispo and with Major General Laura Yeager, who's the commander of the 40th Infantry Division.
Yes, a couple more days anyway.
So you're coming up on retirement.
After 36 years of service.
Wow. So Fountain Valley High School, did you ever in your wildest imagination visualize yourself here, a two-star general?
I never imagined. I'm the daughter of a National Guard officer myself.
Uh-huh.
He's passed away not that long ago, but he retired as a major general himself. So I grew up in a home where there was military service present, and yet it never occurred to me when I was in high school that this would be a career choice for me.
Oh, interesting. So what did you think you were going to do?
I really had no idea what I wanted to do, but I was very interested in biological sciences, and we didn't have a lot of money to spend on my college, so I knew that I would need to live at home and commute. I looked within the radius of where my home was, and I decided that UC Irvine would be a good choice for me because they had a great reputation in biological sciences.
Mm-hmm. Did you join ROTC? How did the military connection come in?
After my first year, my parents told me that they would not be able to continue to afford that school, even though it was very reasonably priced back then. They wanted me to move over to Cal State Long Beach, where my sister was attending college. But by that time, I was already familiar with the campus. I really wanted to stay. It just so happened that I saw a flyer on a bulletin board advertising ROTC, and at the time, there was a $100 stipend per month, and that would be enough money to make up the difference between the tuition at UC Irvine versus Cal State Long Beach. And so I thought, well, you know what? I'll give this a try and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. So that was Army National Guard that you
signed
up?
Army National Guard, uh-huh. Yes. Well, at that time, when you join ROTC, you don't know where you'll end up. You could end up active duty, in the reserves, or in the Guard. And I was just looking for the money to help pay for school at that point.
Little did you know.
Little did I know.
Yeah, 38 years later.
Yeah. I joined and went to camp. That was after my freshman year. And just fell in love with it. Mm-hmm. It was so different from anything that I had been doing. I loved the adventure, learning how to fire weapons and obstacle courses, just the camaraderie of being part of a team of diverse people from all over the United States.
So after graduation from college, mm-hmm. then what happened to you?
Then I actually was commissioned as a second lieutenant and went on active duty, and I was branched Medical Service Corps, which
Explain that. Were you a paramedic? You know, what?
Yes.
Yeah.
So my father was a helicopter pilot in Vietnam, and he served in the National Guard. Actually, he retired as a major general himself, and he was a helicopter pilot. And once I decided I wanted to join the military, I became very interested in flying helicopters. And there's two ways to do that in the Army. One is aviation branch, and the other is Medical Service Corps.
Mm-hmm.
My first choice was aviation, which I didn't get, but I did get Medical Service Corps.
So it's equivalent of a medevac?
Medevac.
Okay.
Exactly. Yep. So that was my pathway to get into learning how to fly helicopters.
Was there a moment, flying a helo is so different than fixed wing.
Yes.
You're going every different direction at once. Was it intimidating to you in training and learning how to fly a helo?
I feel like the Army does a very good job with training. There's really a good way of letting the student know what the standards are and walking you through the process. I never really had any doubt that I would be able to get through the school. I've always felt like if one person can do it, so can I.
So once you're up in the air and flying, did you like that?
I loved it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm still fascinated. If I see a helicopter flying by, it stops me dead in my tracks.
I am right there with you.
Yeah. There's nothing like the feeling of picking up from the ground ground to a hover and a helicopter. It's mm-hmm. amazing.
You can just hear the rotor
sound.
Yeah, and you know, oh, Black Hawk.
Yes.
You know.
The UH-1, the Huey, with the aircraft.
That's what you flew.
I did fly the Black Hawk, later in my career. Mm-hmm. But the sound of the rotor blades, it's like the beating of my heart almost.
I love it. Yeah, I flew on a medevac training mission up at Hunter Liggett.
Yeah.
That was really cool because they're kind of the unsung heroes.
Yes.
You know, they don't get the floodlight.
Yeah. We have an amazing medevac unit here in California. Actually, our medevac unit, when it was deployed to Afghanistan, this would have been a number of years ago, they did a study on the efficacy of our flight crews compared to other flight crews, because what we had done is we'd recruited paramedics to be our flight medics, so it was a higher level of training. And it turned out that if you were a patient on board one of our aircraft, you had a much higher rate of survival than if you were on a medevac from any other unit. What the Army did after they reviewed the study is they raised the standard for all flight medics to be equivalent to what we had established in our unit here in California. So we were really groundbreaking in that way.
Okay, so then there's more to the Laurie Yeager story. You were flying mm-hmm. pilot, but then there was a shift in your career.
Well, when I was promoted, mm-hmm. yes. Yeah, so I was very fortunate to have been nominated and deemed a person that could be promoted general officer. So that was definitely a big turn in my life. And I honestly never expected that to happen mm-hmm. either. I've always just really been focused on what I'm doing at the time.
Right.
And just do the best that I can at the job that I'm assigned to. You know, I never expected to be a general officer. I never expected to be a division commander. It's not something that I had envisioned for myself. I wasn't sure how long I'd even stay in service. All I knew was I was going to stay as long as the Army would let me mm-hmm. and as long as I was enjoying it. And it turns out I've had a wonderful 36-year career.
I know it's hard to talk about yourself, but what makes you an extraordinary commander?
You know, I was talking to my aide to camp on the way here, and I think I'm a very average person. Mm-hmm. I've always had to really try hard at things, but I understand the challenges that people have. Nothing has come super easy to me. I have a very good work ethic, I think that makes a difference. I mean, I definitely understand, you know, what can be challenging, and I think it gives me patience and a certain sense of humility that is helpful.
So at some point, you shipped out and you went downrange to Iraq.
To Iraq, yes.
Yeah. Tell us about when that was and what you did there.
That was really interesting. It was in 2011, and it was around the time that the United States was trying to decide whether we would maintain a presence in Iraq or if we would leave. So while we were there, there was a lot of going back and forth between the United States government and the government of Iraq. And ultimately, it was decided that we would pull everybody out. Mm-hmm. And so being there on the ground and watching all of the challenges and the logistics related to removing all the soldiers, as much of our equipment as we could remove.
The materiel must have been mind-blowing.
Yeah, because we were spread out all over the country, wanting to leave the Iraqis' capability to secure their own country. So it was very interesting to see that from Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
From there.
The other end of the land.
From the other end, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's right.
We had a really great deployment. Main thing is we brought everybody home, mm-hmm. But we flew thousands of hours all over the country, moving soldiers and material, supporting the troops on the ground. And it was one of the most amazing experiences I've had in the Army. I was so fulfilled to be able to actually do the thing that I'd been training for all my career. We had a great team. In retrospect, I know it was very difficult on my family. And it was about, I guess, a year after.
The separation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, about a year after I returned, my son, who's now 27, he told me, "Mom, that was the worst year of my life."
Oh, wow.
And it was really painful.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's quite a burden for our families to bear.
Interesting.
Yes.
So at some point, you become the first female division commander in the United States Army, correct?
Yes, that's true.
That's amazing. And I get to talk to you.
Yeah, I never even imagined this for myself. I was actually on a tour at Fort Bliss, Texas, and I'm reading through my email, and a notice came in about a board. For anybody that was interested in becoming a division commander, the National Guard Bureau was conducting a board, and I read through the memo, and I realized that I meet all the prerequisites for this. And I emailed back to General Baldwin, who's the adjutant general here in California, and I asked in that email, hey, sir, I'm thinking about applying for this board. What do you think? And not long after, maybe within the hour, I got a reply from him, and it just said, yes, exclamation mark.
Wow.
And so I threw
right to the point.
Yeah. He is very succinct.
Yeah.
And so I threw my hat in the ring, and here I am.
What is a division commander of the 40th? You know, what's your primary mission and what's the breadth of what you're responsible for?
So it's a really interesting time to be a division commander. The last 20 years or so, we've been focused primarily on counterinsurgency operations like we did in Iraq. And those operations were very much brigade-centric operations. Mm-hmm. But now we've pivoted because we have near-peer adversaries in Russia and China, and we have to refocus our efforts on large-scale ground combat operations. So there's a requirement for divisions to be ready to do that, and the division commander is responsible for, obviously, the readiness and the training of the brigades under the division, but being able to employ them in a way that we can defeat our near-peer adversaries using combat power. So a lot of aviation mm-hmm. and a lot of fires. And really, that's the primary.
Fires meaning?
The field artillery.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, you know, obviously managing the logistics and the personnel aspects that go with that as well. Mm-hmm. But we've shifted the United States to back to a point, ironically, when I was first commissioned as a second lieutenant, we were very much focused on the threat at the time, which was the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. and being prepared, if necessary, to fight and win in Europe against the Soviet Union. So we're kind of back to where I was when I was a young lieutenant. Interestingly.
Mm-hmm. Huge full circle.
Full circle.
Yeah.
Yes.
So in your time as division commander of the 40th, what sort of training exercises would you focus on and where would you do those?
It's been a really busy 3 years. I mean, as you know, with COVID and the pandemic, there's been a high demand on the National Guard. And within that context, you know, we've been doing a lot of work within the state, wildland firefighting. We also had a very large activation for civil disturbances related to the George Floyd situation. So we do get a lot of practice doing defense in support of civil authorities, which is good practice for our staffs, mm-hmm. basically, because you have to really do the planning and execution to move a number of people and logistics support for them. But on top of that, we also do exercises that are called warfighters, and they're computer simulations, where we basically are able to fight our formations within a simulation against a realistic adversary in the simulation.
And where does a lot of your training take place?
We have done them, warfighters, up in Fort Lewis at Joint Base Lewis-McChord, and just finished one on the 14th of April in Fort Hood, Texas. And the division's also done a couple of exercises with the Japanese self-defense ground forces in Japan. So we did a couple of good exercises with them as well. So we've had a lot of opportunities to practice our tradecraft.
And it's interesting to me in that when you deconstruct a military operation, logistics is everything.
Everything.
Right?
Yes.
Talk to us a little bit about that, because that's something from the outside people take for granted.
They do. Yes. Yeah. Without the, you know, they say the beans and the bullets, mm-hmm. you know,
your gasoline
and your ammunition, you cannot win without really good logistical support. And it's one of the things the United States Army really does quite well.
And that's one of the things that's central to your focus of training, correct?
Yes,
Is that dynamic.
Yes, so we have two command posts. We have a main command post that's really focused primarily on the employment of the weapon systems. And then we have a rear command post that focuses more on the maintenance and logistics for the organization. So that's kind of how we divide things up. And I have mm-hmm. two deputy commanders. I have one deputy commander general for operations and one deputy for support. So those two divide up the workload, one focusing more on admin logistics, the other on the operations.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and even just physically transporting your Humvees or whatever, I mean, just
yes.
amazing what
it
goes
is.
Into it.
It is, and the technology, the communication system, so the command and control systems, being able to talk and move data and keep all the command posts synchronized as to what the situation is in terms of friendly situation and the enemy situation.
So you're commander of the 40th Infantry Division.
Yes.
Implicit is that you have infantry soldiers.
Yes.
Right? So how do the different divisions, how are they distinctive from one another, or are they?
There are a variety of types of division, and the Army is doing some restructuring and some reorganization. Our division, the 40th, would be considered a light division, which means it's got three infantry brigade combat teams. You'll have other divisions, heavy, that have armor brigades, sometimes striker brigades within them.
So you would not have strikers then?
I do not have strikers.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever wish you had them?
You know, I think that being a heavy brigade would be really interesting. At one time, we did have tanks here in California, and it would be wonderful to be able to get an armor brigade back in the state. But right now, the 40th is considered a light division.
Getting to know you and listen to you, there's this strata that gender doesn't even exist, you know, and yet by default, you are a female.
Yes.
So when you look back and you look at yourself and your career, what difference did it make? What role did it play, or was it a non-starter in the scheme of things?
I think because initially I started in the Medical Service Corps, been a high concentration of females within the medical branches for many years, you know, starting with nurses in Vietnam. Nurses, you know, have always been a big part of the Army, and until recently most nurses are female. So initially I was in units where there were a lot of females, so it was not, it didn't feel unusual to me. As I moved up and when I switched into the aviation branch, I started to be in organizations where there were much fewer women. But, you know, it still didn't really make any difference because the Army is very much a standards-based organization, and they lay out exactly what they expect you to do, and no one really cares what ethnicity you are, what religion you are, what gender, provided you're competent.
Right.
And able to do the job. I think that's what makes it such an amazing organization to belong to.
But there has been a default evolution in the military over the span of your career.
Yes.
And one specific thing I can think of is the role of the female in a combat position.
Yes.
Talk to us about looking back and looking forward and here now.
Yeah, I don't know if as a young lieutenant I would have wanted to branch infantry or gone to Ranger School or some of those other opportunities that are now open to women.
But when you went in, you couldn't do that.
Right, and I wanted to fly helicopters, as I mentioned. I would not have been able to fly an Apache helicopter. That was not open to me as a female.
Wow.
Neither the Kiowa as well, because those were considered combat platforms. I would have wanted the choice. That's what I would say. I would have wanted the choice.
And now you have it.
And now I have the choice. And when you look at the senior leaders in the Army, where they come from is the combat arms. And so the path up to senior levels of leadership really depends on having the opportunity to do those jobs. And so it's going to take a few years for women to matriculate up through in enough numbers. So we'll see more females in senior leadership positions. My personal dream is I would love to see a female as the chief of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Yeah.
Then I would know. That's kind of like the last,
last mountain to climb.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
I don't think we're that far off.
No, I don't think we are either.
Yeah.
That female's probably in the Army right now.
Yep.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
It. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in your resume, combined arms training,
yes.
You were involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it was General Hunter Liggett who initiated combined arms philosophy.
Yeah. Yeah. There. When I was a younger officer, there was a thing called Airland Battle, which was really this idea of synchronizing all of the different platforms and ways to defeat the enemy. Now we're looking at what's called multi-domain operations. So it's air, sea, land, space, and cyber, and really trying to synchronize and get the best effects by combining all of those different capabilities that we have. So basically any sensor, any shooter is what we say. And staying ahead of the adversary really is what we're trying to do. Speed is really everything.
I've been involved in California State Office of Emergency Services.
Mm-hmm.
And I took their 3-day anti-cyber terrorism course.
Yes. Cyber is a huge threat. We have very good capability within our ranks, some very talented soldiers and other members, you know, from across the armed forces that are very talented. And that is a domain that we really need to have strong capability in. It touches everything. So we definitely have to be playing a strong defense to make sure that our systems are safe and secure and protected, because definitely cyber is a threat.
So what is next in Laura Yeager's life?
Gosh, I'm really looking forward to being able to travel and spend time with my family, get caught up on things that I've had to put to the wayside, and just spend probably the first year just relaxing and decompressing. The only thing I know for sure is I don't want to work full time.
Right.
That's the only thing I figured out.
Are you involved in nonprofits or greater good organizations? And
I'm starting to look at opportunities. I'm currently a member of the UC Irvine Alumni Board, so a proud anteater, and going to be doing some work with them. And I would like to find other opportunities to continue to contribute, but still leave some time to do the things that I want to do, the fun things that I want to do.
Dream list, place you'd like to travel to where you've never been.
Well, I would really like to go back to Japan. We were able to do a couple exercises there. Really love Japan. Iceland, want to see the Northern Lights there. The list is almost endless. But my best friend from grade school and I are currently planning a trip to Europe. We're going to hopefully get that going here in August and hit the road.
Okay, your turn. Any secrets you're holding back, whatever you want to share, or what you're most proud of looking back over your career?
I would just like to put a shout out to people to consider military service. Right now, only about 1% of Americans make the choice to serve in uniform. And it's becoming more and more what you would call a family business. So it becomes a tradition like it is in my family. My father was in the National Guard. I am now. My son is in the Army Reserves, but probably be transferring back to the Guard. And I think that there is a hesitancy among people because they don't understand what service is like. And what's unfamiliar is scary. And I think if they would try it, they would find how fulfilling it is.
In what ways do you feel it is most rewarding and fulfilling?
I've served on active duty and I've served in the National Guard. I really enjoy serving in the National Guard because you can see the impact that you're having on your own community. And people really appreciate when we're on the ground helping them through some of their worst days. So whether it's a forest fire, floods, earthquakes, when they see us, their day just got a little bit better.
Oh, I love it. I hate to let you go, Laura Yeager, but you've got a lot to do.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for having me.
This is my absolute pleasure. We've been speaking with Major General Laura Yeager, the outgoing commander of the 40th Infantry Division. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
And I'm your host, Tom Wilmer.
Up next on Issues and Ideas, the Mesa Trail at UC Santa Barbara is now open to the public, offering trails for recreation and opportunities for education. Beth Thornton reports.
Yeah, hey, yeah, hey, yeah, hey, yeah, hey,
that's a ceremonial blessing from members of the Barbareno Band of Chumash Indians for the Mesa Trail at UCSB's North Campus Open Space, or NCOS. Opening the trail to the public is the final step of a multi-year campus project to restore the area to its natural habitat. The trail is located on 136 acres off Stork Road on what used to be the Ocean Meadows Golf Course. UCSB acquired the property through a donation from the nonprofit Trust for Public Land.
They donated it to campus in 2013, but of course they weren't really donating a golf course. They were donating the promise of a restoration project.
That's Lisa Stratton, Director of Ecosystem Management for UCSB's Cheadle Center. She says to restore the natural landscape, about 1 million native plants were reintroduced at the site.
So we hand planted approximately 400,000 of those. And then the other sort of 600,000 were actually drill seeded as seeds of the perennial bunch grass, but they have come up and they're succeeding, so we've established 1 million plants.
Stratton says volunteers helped with the planting, and she did some herself, too.
I probably planted Let's say 3,000-4,000, maybe 5,000.
She says before making any big changes to the landscape, they moved existing wildlife to other open spaces like Elwood and Devereaux.
So during the process of restoration, we actually, as we moved dirt and everything, we had people out pre and during catching snakes mostly and lizards and things and moving them to safety.
Stratton says the wetlands that were filled in for the golf course in the 1960s are now restored as part of the Devereaux Slough. Endangered snowy plovers, burrowing owls, and California red-legged frogs are among the many species now living in the North Campus open space.
The migratory birds and the other shorebirds, you know, they fly above. They just have a sixth sense. They see this habitat and they come in and use it. And then the snakes and the mice are just slowly building up their populations.
She says the open space project presented an opportunity to plan ahead and make the area better prepared for rising sea levels.
We created a place for floodwaters to go because one of the climate change impacts we're all seeing is much more intense storms. Already this area flooded. And
Stratton says the residents that live around the open space were included in the planning.
One of the things I really learned through this process is that everyone's thoughts and fears has validity. There's something to it. And I think we learned a lot about what kind of buffer they felt they needed from the people, what would be meaningful for them in terms of maintaining their views or fire risk and all these things. So we incorporated all their concerns into the planning process, I think.
The open space is designed for recreation, like hiking and birding, and also education. K-12 students have access to an outdoor classroom next to the visitor plaza, so they can learn about ecology and the natural world. And UCSB students regularly conduct research on the premises.
I'd say there's kind of three main groups of public. There's the university students, there's K-12 elementary and high school students, and then there's community members. And I think each one of them have a different nexus to the educational opportunities here.
The trails are free and open to the public. Stratton says dogs on leash are welcome, but it's important that they stay on the trail since plants and wildlife are just getting established.
We actually put low fences around the trail to try to help people realize that these grasslands are special and sacred. And that's one thing we wanted to do so that the burrowing owls, the lark sparrows, other ground nesting birds like quails could come in.
Stratton says the campus will continue to manage the space with plans to incorporate Chumash practices for keeping the area protected and thriving.
Right now the grassland is 95% perennial bunch grass, and we hope to continue to add bulbs and wildflowers and bring in Chumash traditional management practices. So one thing is prescribed burning. We've been working with the county on possibly doing big burns of this 15-acre area, maybe every 3-4 years, depending on what it needs ecologically. Many of the Indian practices involve some disturbance, like burning, like cutting back plants and letting them resprout with new straighter stems that could be used for basketry, could be used for bows and arrows, a lot of things. So we're hoping to integrate more of those things and Chumash education.
There are docents on site to answer questions on the third Saturday of each month, and there's a newsletter for updates. For KCBX Issues and Ideas, I'm Beth Thornton.
The Tall Poppy Syndrome is a new book by local author Dr. Doug Garland, who spoke with KCBX's Brian Reynolds.
Hello. Today we are joined by Douglas Garland, who wrote a brand new book called The Tall Poppy Syndrome, The Joy of Cutting Others Down. Welcome, Doug.
My pleasure.
Now, you are a retired physician. Could you talk a little bit about yourself and what led you to write this book?
I became an orthopedic surgeon, and I trained at Tulane and then came to Southern California, USC, and I joined the rehabilitation center as well as ran a private practice. At the rehab center, which is one of the premier centers in the world, I was a chief of 4 different services. Spinal cord injury service was the most prominent service. At the time, I was president of the American Spinal Injury Association. I had been asked to go to Australia to review their 6 rehabilitation programs, which would be about a week at each one. I was at a medical meeting finalizing the trip to Australia. When I got back to my office from that meeting, there was a note on my door that I had been moved from the premier office, corner office with the window, down to some little cubby hole. I couldn't figure out what that was all about, but when I went home that evening and told my wife, she said that they had moved my cheese and that after 30 years, I was persona non grata. She told me to think about resigning. I went to the office the next day, left my key on the table, called Australia, and the people in Australia wanted to know what happened, and I gave them the story, and they said, my goodness, you've been tall poppied.
Wow.
And, of course, that term was completely unfamiliar to me.
You were a celebrity in your field, a noteworthy expert, and lo and behold, the other poppies in the field weren't comfortable with how tall you were, and they gave you a little bit of a haircut.
That's exactly what happened. Fortunately, my wife was intelligent enough to figure it out. Otherwise, I might have tried to pull a power play or try to get my position back. But I did resign, and just because you get cut down is not necessarily bad. It happens to a lot of people. I think it's how you handle that which defines your character. So I didn't have any regrets. In my private hospital, I became chief of the joint service and finished out my professional career. And then when I retired and had plenty of time on my hands, I decided to delve into the tall poppy syndrome and see if it was in America. If it wasn't, was it because of our individualism, which is unique to the world, or was it just unrecognized?
Honestly, I'd never heard of the term tall poppy syndrome, and your book is absolutely fascinating. I think it should be a college-level course. There's so much material that's covered, historic, geographic. I think it's safe to say that the tall poppy syndrome starts, its source is people, might be your colleagues, it might be people who don't even know you, but they have relatively low self-esteem. And when others rise above them, it makes them uncomfortable, maybe even to the point of taking action. Could we talk a little bit about the history of this tall poppy syndrome? I think it goes way back.
It was traced back to Herodotus, who was the Greek historian, and they cut the heads of the wheat off, and that represented cutting down prominent people within the city. And sure enough, Socrates was a victim of the tall poppy syndrome. If we then go to Italy, Livy actually defined the tall poppy syndrome as we know it. It was during the kingdom period, which was 750 BC to 500 BC. The last leader, his son was governing the neighboring city, and he couldn't do it. So he sent a trooper back to talk to his father, and he just walked out into the field of poppies and lopped off the tall heads. And so when the runner went back to the son, he figured out immediately that he needed to cut down the prominent leaders in the city so that he would have no competition in governing. And so that's the first mention of the tall poppy syndrome. And then, of course, Caesar himself became tall poppied. And so from that point on, I really understood the syndrome, and I could identify it in almost every country, almost every time period. At that time, the syndrome was about the true tall poppy, but there's a lot of that happening in people that aren't tall. So in order to reconcile this, I changed it to be peer-to-peer, which is within a tribe. So in the peer-to-peer, that happens within your family. That happens within your neighborhood, that happens within your schools, that happens within your workplace. So then when we look in the peer-to-peer, it's what drives it. And yes, it usually is the more low self-esteem person, and it's driven by envy. Aristotle divided envy into two forms, good envy and bad envy. Good envy is seeing your neighbor has a nice home, nice car, a nice yard, and you try and emulate him and mimic what he's done. Bad envy is if you assume that you can't do that, then you either directly or indirectly, directly would be tearing his yard up or throwing dog poop on it, and indirectly would be disparaging remarks to the neighbors about what a jerk that guy is showing off. So that concept is what we see throughout America, which goes undescribed. And the public form is very common. So we have a lot of more tall poppies in America than any other country. And they're concentrated in our politics, in our sports, in our media, and in Hollywood. And the cutting down is a little different. Usually this population have garnered the rightful accolades, but because of egregious activity, which is frequently driven by pride, lust, and greed, the public makes a judgment that they've become too big for their britches and they want to cut them down.
I'd like to remind everyone that I am Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by a retired physician, Douglas Garland, who's written a new book called The Tall Poppy Syndrome, The Joy of Cutting Others Down. Because the topic is so vast, at least to me, your book is a real page-turner, and I don't mean that as a cliche. Let's talk a little bit about Australia and its unique TPS situation, and then what's going on in the United States, especially trends.
Well, the Australian country was founded as a penal colony from England. And in a penal colony, the people are equal within that system. And so that gave rise to the culture in Australia, which is an egalitarian society. And so when I was doing my research of the English-speaking countries, the most prominent tall poppy syndrome population was in Australia, and they just do not tolerate a tall poppy. It is their national pastime to cut them down so they still have that penal mentality of everybody being equal. So that was one of my premises then in America, that we had worshiped the individual. That was what our country was founded on, the right to pursue happiness. And I thought, well, maybe it was our individualistic idea that prevented the syndrome from being here. The thing that I found was that actually caused more tall poppy syndrome in America than even Australia. We have to compete. We have a meritocracy, and anytime we have competition, somebody's going to get hurt. I changed the conclusion to individuality actually causing it. So I feel it's mainly unrecognized here, but present everywhere.
An example that comes to mind is celebrities, rock stars, movie stars, other people who rise above, you know, the rest of the field of poppies. And they rise quickly a lot of times, but then they could be cut down in a heartbeat. The most recent episode I can think of is Will Smith and the slap at the Oscars. The justice is swift and brutal here in this country.
My saying is that envy is the currency of the internet. And you're right. It's so rapid now. Well, the Will Smith slap is a really good example. He became angry at the remark that Chris Rock stated about his wife, that anger grew, he has pride, and that drove him to revenge. And there's a saying that if you seek revenge, dig two graves. He may never recover professionally from that episode on TV. The movie industry, that happens all the time. Sports figures, business people.
What would you tell people that are either wondering if this thing exists, or they're worried about it happening to them, or they see it happening to a loved one? What would you say to them?
Well, the first thing in medicine, we have to make a diagnosis before we can cure the problem. So my first goal of the book was to identify it to the public. But once you identify it, then you have to go through the judgments when you see the cutting down occur. So you have, is it bad behavior on the cutter? Is it bad behavior on the cuttee? And then you have to make a judgment. You should have the emotional critical response of self-reflection and figuring out what your part is in all this. And it should help you grow, and it should help you have empathy for maybe the cuttee who has some low self-esteem, and maybe look to see how you could help that person.
I am Brian Reynolds. Today we were joined by retired physician Douglas Garland, who's written a brand new and fascinating book, The Tall Poppy Syndrome, The Joy of Cutting Others Down. Thank you so much, Doug.
My pleasure.
And finally on Issues and Ideas, Playing with Food.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food. Everyone loves mushrooms. Except me. I don't like mushrooms. But so many people do that playing with food couldn't possibly pass up an opportunity to discover what's going on in the Central Coast mushroom scene. When I think of local mushrooms, I think of foraging, so I went to Fiscalini Ranch with Dennis Sheridan, veteran forager. Unfortunately, California hasn't seen much rain, so there wasn't an abundance of mushrooms, but we still had a good time.
We're here on the Fiscalini Ranch. We're looking for mushrooms.
Are you an avid mushroom forager?
Yes. I've been interested in identifying them and occasionally eating them for more than 40 years.
And here on the Fiscalini Ranch, what percentage of the mushrooms are edible and what percentage are poisonous?
As few as 5% could be poisonous. And it's likely that, depending on what your palate is, it could be 15 or 20% that are edible, which leaves a lot in the middle that we don't talk about being edible or not.
What's in that middle? Just stuff that doesn't taste good?
The one that I just pointed out, this cryptic globe fungus. It's a beautiful or an unusual mushroom that has an unusual story to tell about it. And it's working with a beetle to make these spores spread around. So each one has a different story. And so I would never think about eating that. But I like knowing about it, thinking about it, enjoying it.
Well, what's the best way to start foraging?
Get here on a cool day early after a rain. Many of these fungi will be either mycorrhizal, that's a nice word, or saprophytic, meaning they decay a rotten log, they make it rot. Or there are other categories as well, but it hasn't rained in 6 weeks, or I don't know how long. So I just look at an open meadowy-ish kind of area, in particular the interface with down or dead wood or logs, to see if there's something that jumps out at me. And right now I'm not seeing anything other than beauty. This is a good example of the interface that I said I like to look between. And the mycorrhizal relationships that are going on here are definitely putting up lots of mushrooms, but just not in this last 6 weeks. I think this is a carcass of a mushroom that's just old and dead and dried.
Would you be looking in the same places if you were looking for mushrooms that you wanted to eat?
Yes, both are the same. Okay. I look for mushrooms not exclusively or not to eat them. I look at them to see them, admire them, understand them, photograph them, enjoy them. If there are some that I do like to eat, I do take some mushrooms for the table. But that's not my main goal at all. It's like down on the list. The Fiscalini Ranch has posted no collecting mushrooms on this property unless it's for educational purposes.
So we won't be taking any mushrooms home today?
Unless it's for educational purposes. I might be tricking myself, but I think I see a mushroom. Do you want to stand here until you see it?
Okay. You said to look at the interface.
Yeah.
Right? So looking
at the base of trees.
Base of trees.
Logs or branches or...
I don't see it yet. It's probably going to be super obvious.
I'll get you warmer and warmer as
okay.
we go.
Oh, I see the whole cluster. Look at that. Those are beautiful.
So this is a large and a group clustering mushrooms. The giant laughing Jim. Gymnophilus spectabilis. It's not good to eat. It doesn't taste good. And it has some qualities that if eaten, it makes you laugh uncontrollably. That's not a good thing because you might be poisoning yourself simultaneously. But this is a very, very, very old clump. It's dead and dried and is beginning to rot away.
Here's some.
Oh, yay, yay, yay. Now, right there at this interface between the grassland to hard-packed soil, and this one, if I can find a young enough one, none of them look young.
No.
But the youngest one might be this one. Mm-hmm. When I look underneath it, I'm hoping to see amethyst-colored gills. Yeah, this is doing it.
Oh, wow. Look at that.
It's very cool. I like that color.
I think we've been pretty successful today.
Yeah.
Considering that we haven't had rain for 6, 7, 8 weeks.
And we're only seeing dead mushrooms. More evidence of dead mushrooms, or meaning way past ripeness.
Look.
1, 2, 3, 4. We're in the right spot. Just not at the right time.
It's a mushroom graveyard.
We should have been here 2 weeks ago. Ah! Our first one.
Wow.
Those are the ones that we found all dead in just the shells of them. This is the iconic mushroom from these forests called Amanita muscaria, or the fly agaric. It's a beautiful mushroom.
So a little luck there at the end, but because of the lack of rain and Fiscalini's rules, it wasn't the forest-to-table experience I was hoping for. Several entrepreneurs on the Central Coast, though, have worked around the mushroom moisture misfortune. I visited two home growers of mushrooms, believe it or not, on a sizable lot out by the San Luis Obispo Country Club and at the end of a cul-de-sac in Morro Bay. You won't see vast fields of mushrooms, but the mushrooms are there.
I am Christoph O'Brien, and I am the owner of Mushroom Munch, based here in San Luis Obispo. Grow facility is a 100-year-old redwood barn, and we have a grow tent inside of it. It's basically a greenhouse.
Okay, great. Can you show me around?
Sure, yeah. Let's head inside.
Okay, and it is a barn.
Yes, definitely a barn. So we got a tractor in here, as you can see, and hay. But yeah, so over here we have our gauges, which read the temperature and the humidity. I like to check those as soon as I get inside so I know what's going on. At the moment, it's 57 in the tent, 87% humidity in the tent as well. I believe the tent is 8 or 9 by 10.
Oh, wow. Okay. It looks like a bunch of actual, like, ripe cheese.
Ripe cheese. Yeah, these are the bread, the blocks. So this is the grow room. So you see we got some blue oysters going over here, a lot of freshies, all the shiitake in the back, and linesmen, of course, on this side. So these are the popular ones that everyone loves and I can't grow enough of. They just fly off. I can sell them all before I even get to the market. It's amazing. The grow blocks are essentially hardwood substrates mixed in with some supplementation, rye grain and oyster sawdust, oyster shell, of course. That is then inoculated with whatever strain we are using at the time, whether it be lion's mane, oyster, shiitake, and we do chestnuts as well. Growing off the block, so the mycelium is the part that is inside the bag and is taking over and consuming the inside of the block, all the substrate and nutrients in there. My business partner, who is in Oregon, sells me the blocks. He has a whole sterilization facility up there, so I go up about once a month to Oregon, bring my blocks down, and yeah, set them up in the greenhouse and try to get as much control of the environment for them to get their perfect fruiting. Yeah, it's all natural light in the barn, so yeah, very low tech in that sense. No heating, it's all, you know, from the outside temperature. The temperature and humidity is all from the humidifier and the misting system. The blocks usually get about 2 to 3 flushes. We call them fruitings as well. Okay. So the first fruit, of course, is going to be the biggest, usually about a pound in size, but it can vary, you know, depending on the climate that we have. Mushrooms love, of course, humidity. And since I'm such a low-tech facility, I depend a lot on the, you know, outside climate as well. So they can last up to 2 months, you know, if we're going to get a second fruiting at least. After they're done, they're great for compost. The neighbors next door, they actually have a soil tilling, and they use it for the garden.
And will they sometimes get mushrooms that grow up?
They do, yes.
And are they still edible for them?
Absolutely, yeah. They might be more susceptible to bugs, like any wild mushroom that you'd find out in nature.
How do you know when they're ready or ripe?
Mostly just by the looks of it. So as you can see with the blue oyster, once they're small like that, they have that nice, you know, small cap, a lot of color to the mushroom as well. Once they get bigger and fannier, they have more of a gray, but still a bluish tint to them. But these right here, we can probably pick them today if you'd like. The lion's mane, the way we like to pick them is when it gets these little tooth combs, the teeth that hang off and looks more shaggy, more like a lion's mane and hairy. A lot of people like that factor too. They like that it looks the way it does, you know.
Ooh, this looks pretty gnarly, actually.
Yeah, the shiitake blocks we take out of the bag and they just grow straight on the shelf like that.
How did you get into this?
I had a teacher at college at Cuesta. He was our biology teacher and he would take us foraging in the Los Osos Oaks Preserve. And we just find all kinds of mushrooms, and that's kind of what kicked off my, you know, obsession. A lot of people like the cooking factor, you know, how do we cook it? How do we eat it? And basically what most of the, mushroom people out there say is cook your mushrooms. Don't eat them raw, especially the best way to get the nutrients out of them is to cook them, because they have hard cell walls called cytokines that need to be broken down to release those medicinal benefits, which are like the beta glucans and, you know, depending on the variety, whatever medicinal compound is in there.
And what made you choose these four varieties of mushrooms?
They just seem very popular. I do different varieties as well during the warmer months. So I do the golden oyster and salmon oyster. This process is where we're going to create our own growing medium. This is some shredded wood, and I want to shred it even finer. So that way we can have a quicker inoculation when I get the spawn. And then do a lime pasteurization, which is we add water and hydrated lime, let that soak. That process then creates the pH so high that it kills all bacteria and any kind of contaminants in there. So it's then ready to be inoculated with the variety. I'm gonna go ahead and get the weed eater started.
Uh-oh.
Okay. I know, watch out. Oh wait, safety first. So that's pretty fine.
So you had the hay in a 55-gallon garbage can.
Yeah.
And you use the weed eater like an immersion blender.
Pretty much, okay. Yeah. That's the gist of it.
And that means you won't have to drive up to Oregon?
For certain varieties. I still have to do that for the hardwood substrate varieties.
Are there any native California species of mushrooms that are edible?
Absolutely, yeah. I've found lion's mane, found oysters, of course. Everyone loves the California chanterelles. Those are good ones to eat, but can't cultivate those, unfortunately, just like a truffle.
Didn't know that.
Yeah.
Why can't you cultivate them?
They need to be grown on oak trees that are mature. When a baby oak is, you know, growing, the mushroom and the tree will coexist and grow alongside each other and help each other proliferate. I love when I find one that's as big as my head. It's like when you find one that big, you're just kind of astounded. It's like how big the mushrooms can get out in the wild. It just really depends on, you know, the factors going on with the climate and the nutrition.
Will something the size of your head be edible?
Absolutely, yeah. It was a lion's mane that I actually found. I wish I would have weighed it. I ended up preserving some of it. I ate some of it as well, but it was just so much mushroom, I couldn't eat it all. Okay. So just dried it out, and like kind of do at the market, I have a dried variety as well that people like to eat. What they'll do is they'll rehydrate them or put them in ramen, broth, soup, stews. Pasta dishes are great for dried mushrooms as well.
Christoph offered some great cooking tips, perfect for playing with food, and it would have been amazing if Dennis and I would have stumbled across a mushroom the size of my head. Over in Morro Bay, the process is similar, yet different. You will hear Highway 1 traffic on and off because the cul-de-sac is right next to the highway, but that doesn't affect the quality of the mushrooms.
Rosa, as you know, I grow gourmet mushrooms. This is my lab. This is where I do all my clean work. So mushrooms, each strain needs to be isolated, and every grower kind of does something different. Some growers work straight from, this is a liquid culture. So this is mycelium suspended in liquid. It lasts basically forever. And this has just a tiny bit of mycelium floating around, and you can squirt this directly into a sterilized substrate. I use rye grain, or you can put it on a petri dish, which is what I use, and I grow it out on the petri dish. And once these are fully colonized, so this is just the mycelium for black oyster mushroom. It's nice and clean. You can tell because it's all white. It's just one variety. This one is a contaminated one, so you can get an idea. See, that's not what we want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it happens though. So that's why we work in here. This is a flow hood that blows 99% clean air over the work area. Once these grow out, we use some of this and we put it in this, which has been sterilized in a pressure cooker.
What is it?
It is rye grain. It's organic rye grain. So I soak it to hydrate it, and then I bag it and I cook it at a really high temperature to avoid any possible contaminants or competitors. So when we put this in, if we've done our job right, then it will grow out and colonize like this.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, isn't that neat? It's already even trying to fruit in there. This is definitely ready to expand. So this will go into a substrate of mostly wood, and it'll grow us mushrooms over time. The whole process takes about 3 months.
Okay, so you've taken mycelium, the liquid cultures, you put them in a petri dish, and then you put it in the rye grain in a gallon plastic bag. It gets all furry, white and furry.
Yeah, it's the mycelium basically consuming the rye grain. It's like eating it.
Okay.
And expanding.
And then you're going to go put it on the substrate.
Yeah.
Is that what's next door?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'll show you.
Okay,
I'll
cool.
I'm pretty basic. I do a really low cost, low tech method. And I use a cement mixer to mix my substrate. And we put it in that tray there and we bag it from there. And once it's bagged, it goes into incubation. They come in here after we've bagged them. Basically, the grain delivers the mycelium to the substrate, and eventually it will fill out completely like this.
It looks like giant sausages.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Salumeria.
Yeah, particularly that they're white, so it looks like it is mold that grows on the outside of the salami. So this looks exactly like a giant salami.
It does. Yeah. It does. Each one of these grains will deliver the mycelium that we're trying to expand, and it'll slowly colonize this whole bag. So like these were just done on the 9th, so they're just lightly grown out, and these were done January 23rd, and they're almost fully colonized.
And you've poked holes in them.
Because the mycelium needs to breathe. It breathes oxygen, just like we do. That's why fungus has its own kingdom, because they're not a plant. They don't do the carbon dioxide thing. They breathe oxygen like we do.
So where do these sausages go next?
I'll show you.
Okay.
Sorry, my chickens are out. So when they're ready, we bring them out here.
Oh, wow. Yep. Wow. So we're in a greenhouse, just like an off-the-shelf greenhouse. The sausages have been brought in here, and they have mushrooms growing out of them.
Lots.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Wow. I don't know what else to say, but wow. So this is 3 months later.
Yeah, this is about 3 months later, starting from the petri dish all the way to fruiting. And these will fruit several times. These, for example, see, they already have some algae growing on them just because it's a high moisture environment. It doesn't hurt anything. These are, they're almost done. They're getting really close to being done. They're very light now. The mushrooms have consumed a lot of the nutrients. And then that's what we use to compost.
And you only do these types of mushrooms?
Oysters is definitely my specialty. They like this method a lot. When I first started growing, I was feeling super ambitious and tried all kinds of varieties, a lot of medicinals. And they're just, unfortunately, very slow growing. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's a business. So I have to keep that in mind. I need to produce something that pays me back. And these guys pay dividends. They do great. They love this environment. They're delicious. People love them.
Is this your primary business?
This is my primary business. I work from home and, you know, get to be with my daughter full time. She was the inspiration behind starting this. I started in 2018. I had a much smaller operation at my old property. Definitely moving here gave me the opportunity to double up. So I started just with one large greenhouse at my old place. And then when I got here, I split that into two and have since added two more greenhouses and the permanent structures for incubation in the lab. This is definitely an unconventional way of growing them. And when I started growing, I wasn't sure it would work. But I had decided that if I couldn't do it this way, that I wasn't going to do it because it seemed like what I would have to put in versus what I got out was it too imbalanced. Because a lot of it is to leave no impact. You know, I don't want to use as much plastic as some of the other growers or as much energy. They, you know, they'll steam sterilize their substrate. I just do a pasteurization process. You can see this method, but typically they'll do it on straw, which I really didn't want to work with. It's very messy, gets in your clothes, it's painful. Like, I did not want to deal with that. So I did a lot of experimentation and this worked. So I stuck with it, which is kind of also how I've specialized down to oysters because they like this particular method. Some of the other slower growing mushrooms don't do so well. They need more supplementation, and the higher supplementation, the higher you risk contamination, which, you know, you don't get mushrooms because you have too many competitors in your substrate. This works. Yeah.
Rosa taught me how to harvest, and that was fun. Both her business and Christoph's were amazing. Growing mushrooms looks easy, but the biology behind it is very important. Despite Rosa saying that her method is unconventional, there are no shortcuts when dealing with a living organism. Anytime you hear contamination or sterilization over and over again, that's your clue to realize that the process is a bit meticulous. The main difference between Christoph and Rosa's growing methods, from my novice observations, is the type of substrate and the sterilization method. Christoph has more solid blocks sterilized by his friend in Oregon, and by the way, he also grows mushrooms straight on logs. Rosa pasteurizes her own grain, then she puts it in bags, which then look like giant salami. Both methods offer them thriving mushroom businesses. The next time you're out for a walk in the woods, preferably a couple weeks after a rain, look down on the ground and notice the food that nature provides. Of course, be careful if you're foraging. Know what you're picking before you attempt to eat it. Next time you're at the farmer's market checking out the mushroom stalls, know that those growers are all fungi. This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.